Today's January 28th, first meeting of this year. With us are Representative Bob Boo, Representative Jay Ramirez, Representative Mark Newman, and myself, Chair Olson. First bill today will be House Bill 315, and I believe Linda Hayes is going to be carrying it for Representative Samuels.
And I'm going to invite Pat Davidson up to the table.
Welcome aboard, both of you.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Linda Hayes, staff to Representative Ralph Samuels, Chair of the LBNA Committee. House Bill 315, as introduced by the LBNA Committee, would extend the sunset date of the Big Game Commercial Services Board. This complies with the recommendation of Division of Ledge Audit, which recently reviewed the activities of the board. With me today is Pat Davidson, the legislative auditor, who will walk through the findings of the audit.
Good afternoon. We haven't seen you for a while.
Since last session.
Yeah.
For the record, Pat Davidson, representing the Division of Legislative Audit. As Linda indicated, our report did recommend one statutory change, and that was to extend the termination date to the year 2012. This would be a four-year extension as opposed to an eight-year extension that you'll oftentimes see. However, this board was reconstituted only a couple of years ago, so we only had a couple of years of activity to review, and therefore we recommended only a four-year extension. The other issues identified in the audit were, I would categorize more as administrative issues, that it really is up to the division that needs to be dealt with. There wasn't really anything happening at the board that we thought that the board was particularly deficient in. It was more divisional operations. And with that, if there's any questions.
Representative Booth? I might add for the record that we've been joined by Representative Gardner and Representative Gatto.
Through the chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Davidson, I have a couple questions on your finding and recommendations. There are some questions that came up in review. I was wondering if you could answer some inquiries regarding the first, second, and third that are posted on page 9 of the finding and recommendation, if you would address those, please.
Through the chair, Representative Book. Certainly. The first issue identified under an encompassing recommendation about the division of the corporation's business and professional licensing should ensure that their procedures are being adhered to by staff. The first one is that the licensing files were missing certain documentation. During part of the, as part of the audit, we actually go in, look at files, make sure that they are, that they have all the information that is required. Any deficiencies, we look to see follow up on sort of where it fell down. And in this case, what we saw was that for the most part, it was just more information gathering on the part of the licensing examiner. With regard to the second one, the public notice not issued for an exam. What we found were that one of the examinations was not adequately public noticed. Oftentimes, I would, when we looked at that, it certainly is a problem to the extent that it's a serious problem, not so much. If you are sitting for an exam, you're not going to be limiting yourself to public notice information. There's a lot of other, as somebody who has sat for a licensing examination, you're just not going to rely solely on a public notice. So again, when we evaluated that one, we did see it as a deficiency, should be addressed, but it was not of a substantial concern to us. And then the third one was proposed regulations issued by the board were not publicly noticed in a timely manner. What we found was that, again, the licensing support for this board wasn't really up to snuff. And what we found was that they were trying to public notice the regulations. They were trying to get the regulations done in draft. It just didn't follow the proper sequence to have those things happen in the order in which they needed to. Individually, any of these things might not be what we would consider recommendation material, but however, taken as a whole, we did find that they were significant enough occurrences to warrant a recommendation to the department.
Through the chair, to follow up. So in your view, these have been caretaken for to your satisfaction?
Through the chair. The department did respond that they were going to address these issues, and I do know that there was some staff changes.
Thank you.
We've been joined by Representative Ledoux and Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Comment? Chair. Ms. Davidson, in your findings and recommendations, paragraph number 3, I guess it is, says the board and the division should review licensing fees and regulatory costs and increase fees to cover annual operating costs. Whose fees are you increasing?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, the board is supported by fees and is required to be financially supported by the fees. And what we saw with that their costs were exceeding the revenues coming in. And so while we don't recommend which particular fee, whether it be there's a whole list of fees, just that the revenues need to be increased, and it's up to the division to ensure that the fees are sufficient to come in. However, they usually work with the board to identify which specific fees get increased.
Sure.
Follow up.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Ms. Davidson, do you think that those fees would probably be coming in an increase in hunting license?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, the fees are coming in from the licensing of master guides, registered guide outfitters, Class A assistants. Sports hunting and fishing license fees actually go into the Fish and Game Fund, and they do not support the board at all.
That's all I wanted to make sure of there. Mr. Chair, one more question, please.
Sure.
Also, this is a big game commercial services board, and the board has some sanctioned subcommittees with a state lands subcommittee. Who's on that, and what issues are they presently working on?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, I'm afraid I don't have that information for you. However, there may be other people in the audience that have that information.
Okay.
Sir, anybody that might have that information?
I do have that information.
Please join us.
Yeah, my name is Paul Johnson. I'm from Elfin Cove, Alaska. I have the position of chairing the board at this point in time. We started up as soon as our inception came of a state land committee, and it was established. We've had a couple of different leaders that have been involved in that. The main one has been Bobby Fithian. This was brought to the attention of the board that something needed to be worked out on state lands, and so we asked the committee to come forward to what they thought their solutions would be that we could deal with, and what they thought solutions other agencies could deal with. At this point in time, they've been working with the Department of Natural Resources and the other issues that we could deal with, we have dealt with, mainly on ethical issues. There's a couple of cleanup areas in that ethical portion, but basically that's what we handled. The rest of it is now in DNR's hands.
Follow.
As far as, I guess, on state lands, you know, kind of, we're looking at areas. Could you kind of explain a little bit what that committee would look at?
The committee is just coming up with what the problems are and coming up with talking to the different groups and agencies, from Fish and Game to DNR and to us. And to DNR, they have had major discussions, part of that committee, and those committees not under on their people on their own. And DNR is now taking a look at what to do with those state lands. As far as ours goes, we have dealt with just the ethical issues.
Okay, maybe I'm ask it in a different way.
Sure.
I'm trying to figure out what the state land subcommittee does. I know that you had some issues, but What do they do?
We broke out in the very beginning. What's that?
What's their mission? What do they do?
Through the chair, their mission was to, when we first started the board back up again, we had a whole group of people who deal on just state lands who felt the complexities on state lands and the problems on state lands were to the point that something had to be done. And our board does not have the statute authority to do some of the things that they would like to have done. So I told them, if you need to work with that, you need to go to DNR. Does that help, what I'm saying? We don't have the statutory authority to do the things that they wanted to do. On the issues of ethical issues, we did have the statutory authority.
I'll let some other members ask some questions. Maybe we can go back to that.
Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at recommendation number 5, and I got such a kick out of it because I'd never seen the likes of it in my life. And what it says is the board should cease the electronic accumulation of information gathered from hunt records and transporter reports. Every other recommendation is the reverse. So you discovered something here that sometimes information isn't all that valuable. And does that spread to any other place? Maybe we need to make that recommendation more often, that quit collecting information that just gets stored and is unusable by anyone else.
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, I must admit, writing that recommendation was a very different one for us because we are about data. Oftentimes, we're required to verify data. We're about controlling data and verifying and so on and so forth. So, yes, it is a highly unusual recommendation in our report. However, what we found is we did an audit a couple of years ago, right before the board was reinstated. And what we found is that they were keeping enormous amounts of records. And to anybody's knowledge, legislative audit was the only person that ever asked to see the data. So we come back a couple years later and we look at the amount of effort that is going into keeping this data. And again, we ask the question, well, who's using this? And while a lot of people had thought this person A or group B were using it, when we went to person A or we went to group B, we found that they hadn't actually been using it. This is a recommendation, however, that the agency disagrees with us. And our recommendation really comes down to identify who your users are. Make sure if you're going to collect the data, make sure it's going to be in a usable format for them. Right now, when we are looking at it, they're doing a lot of key punch of very, very old hunt records. Again, nobody had been using it. Maybe they didn't use it because it wasn't available to them, but there didn't seem to be anybody wanting that information. Possibly, instead of doing that, you wanted to digitize the records, make it a searchable database. But until you identify who your users are, you know, don't invest a lot of time, effort, and energy into that.
Good. Thank you, sir.
Representative Booth.
Through the chair, on this point, I wonder if we have somebody in the room. We do have a letter from Commissioner Nadi stating that they would like to retain those data. Is that what? Do we have anybody who is here to support that side of the argument?
And through the chair, Representative Book, again. Our recommendation is based on the fact that nobody was using them.
I understand.
If they can come up with users with an identifiable need, we're not opposed to it.
Right.
We're just, you know, make sure you have a user first.
Right.
Okay. Please join us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Strickler. I'm the chief licensure in the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing, Department of Commerce, formerly known as Occupational Licensing. We have a long name now. Through the chairman, to answer Representative Book's question here about the database, it has been in statutes for years that every guide that's allowed to contract submit what was used to be known as a financial remuneration form. It's basically a guide client contract. By statute, those contracts are confidential. It was a statutory requirement that remained on the books, so we continue to collect this data from our licensees. The data was primarily used by law enforcement agencies. Public safety enforcement officers are big users of it. The issue that we encountered is that when we get troopers requesting copies of this data, we have one licensing staff to research all the licensees, to make copies of all the data, certify all the copies of the records or the reports so that the troopers can use to build their case and use that record in court. So we were always behind the eight ball in responding to these requests. And that's why these reports, although they were available, were not, because of its confidential nature, they weren't widely requested by a lot of other agencies. People could not look at them unless they were an enforcement agency by statute. What we have done at the request of the newly established board is to try to put all this data into an electronic format so that the enforcement agencies that obtain permission from us can do their own queries and can scan. We would scan the document itself. They can perform queries and they can download and print the document themselves, so it would be less of a burden to our licensing staff in making copies and certifying those copies. And that's the process that we want to continue. We've made big headway to get the data into the system. For example, there's what's called the transporter activity report forms from all of the transporter licensees. We were able to catch up all the data from 1993 to October of 2007. That is currently in the system. We are now working on what's called the guide hunt records. And that's where a large focus interest is also on those reports. So we're now working from 2007, which is the most useful information to enforcement officers, and working backwards to try to capture some of the earlier data.
Through the chair? Yes. Would you say that those practices that you're trying to maintain are currently followed by other states, and that you are trying to get up to speed with the record keeping of those other agencies?
Through the chair, I'm not sure if other state guide licensing boards have this requirement. Maybe Mr. Johnson can speak to that. But I know for this state, we've gained the support of the state troopers, public safety, fish and wildlife officers, not only state, but the national, the federal agencies as well.
Okay. I appreciate your comments. Thank you.
Representative Liddell.
I guess I'm not totally sure who or whom to ask this question to, but I see that all that is before us is extending the big game service board. So whether or not all of these recommendations are followed or not followed, does that really, I'm just trying to figure out where it kind of fits in to here. I mean, we could extend the big game service board, which I support, but then these recommendations would necessarily be followed, or maybe they're going to be followed, maybe they're not going to be followed. Am I correct here that what's before us doesn't actually address all of these?
Yeah, what's before us extending the bill to 2012. Ms. Davidson?
Thank you. Again, this is Pat Davidson. In response to Representative Ledoux's question through the chair, the bill in front of you is the only thing that requires statutory changes. The report is for, it's a statutory requirement that we do one of these reports. The evaluation criteria looks at a variety of issues. Sometimes if we saw substantial problems that had been ongoing or dealt with statutory issues, we'd be making recommendations for statutory changes. However, these recommendations don't rise to that level. They're more for an information from the committee so that, you understand how the board is doing and how the support for the board is functioning. And I would say the board is functioning. Again, we did recommend the four-year extension. However, there's some areas, just to let the committee members know, that there were some areas that we thought were necessary to improve the administrative activities of the board.
Thanks.
Certainly.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that Representative Ledoux's point is well taken. But I have to say my curiosity is piqued about Ms. Strickler's testimony, and if you'll just bear with me for a minute, I'm curious, in all these other agencies that said they liked the idea of having this data accessible, I guess number one is, have any of them asked about using it now that you've put this effort into getting it? And then secondly, if they do use it, do they really need to go back into the 80s, or are they interested in last year's licensing and maybe it would make sense to, you know, simply have a database of today on out?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner. Yes, other agencies have expressed interest in this. In fact, I have a few requests because this is a secured website that we're going to make this data available from. They're waiting anxiously to sign up for the data. First on the list is the Tongass National Forest Enforcement Officers and also Public Safety from Fairbanks. As far as the data going into the database, we've asked the board that if we can cut off at a certain point. So far, we're still working at it. We have quite a ways to go to input more of the hunt records, so we hope to get a definite answer from the board, which is not crucial at this time, because we have quite a bit of reports coming in, as you can imagine, from all the hunters that have clients throughout the year. There's one other issue in that some of these agencies have offered to give the division some money to help fund this project, but we have not sat down to talk about dollar amounts or what the entire project cost or what they should pay in to have access to this, but that's also a possibility.
Thank you. And follow up, Mr. Chair, perhaps that would help address some of this $52,000 operating deficit if they really do want the data for their purposes and they need it to go back 15, 20 years. I can't imagine why offhand, but maybe that's the case. Thank you.
Pat, are you done?
Nope, not yet.
Not yet. Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The fact that the board is composed of 9 members, and 4 of those 9 are either registered guides or registered transporters, mm-hmm. is that considered lopsided?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, is your question lopsided in terms of the number of professionals on the board vis-a-vis public members?
Right.
Most occupational licensing boards in this state do have a majority membership of professionals being licensed.
Majority?
Yes.
I see. Thank you.
Any further questions for Ms. Davidson? Thanks again, Pat. Thank you. Let's see. Paul Johnson, you want to join us again?
Again, my name is Paul Johnson. I'm the chair of the Big Game Commercial Services Board, and thank you for your time. I feel that, to answer maybe a couple questions also, but I feel that since our 10 years of not having a board functioning, we see a lot of good things coming along, and it's been a very healthy process. I think it's important to hold this industry together in this state. It's a $200 million industry, even though it's spread out. It's a very important aspect for many of us. I would appreciate the reauthorization of the board. I will answer your question. We have talked with basically leaving it up to public safety, how far back they would like to go, what statutory of their statutory limitations are. We're not going back to the 80s, obviously. A very strong funding issue, but it is important to go back at least 3 years, which there's their statutory authority. I think I left Representative Newman. I guess I I think that he's got some questions, and I've been sitting there trying to think that one over. But anyway, I'm here to answer questions. Our board members are made up of 9 members, 2 of them private landholders, 1 public member, 1 member that's from the Board of Game that sits on the board. So we have a liaison between the Board of Game and this board, 2 transporters, and 2 guides.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, I have a constituent. We've got some homestead property up by Squetna.
Mm-hmm.
You probably know him.
Maybe, maybe not. Anyway.
He's been around
a while.
I
hope so. Yeah, okay.
And he's got some cabins there, and he wants to kind of do a little retirement. And there's a lot of people go hunting up around that area. And he's got a snowmobile. And now you can transport, you don't need a transporter's license to transport by air, but you do by boat or ATV.
No, sir. By air, under, you have to have a Part 135 certificate. If you are transporting more than a point-to-point rate, as, for instance, if you walked into a Part 135 operator and asked for a point-to-point rate, you do have to have a transporter license. If you are actually selling the resource use, this, the basic makeup of the board and the requirements of transporters and guides was a task force that was put together in 91 or 92. Henry Springer was the chair of the first board of that task force. And that is when the hats were put on different people at that time. And no longer was it the guide board, it became the Big Game Transporters or Big Game Commercial Services Board. And those have been in law all the way along in statute, or in regulation and statute. And then when the board was sunsetted in 95 over a whole litany of issues, at that point in time, it was put into, a lot of these were put into statute. So nothing there has changed. That has been the same all the way along. But yes, if you do have an airplane, you do have to have a transporter's license if you're charging more than a rate point-to-point fee. Correct.
But what kind of what I was getting at is he would like to be able to, if I went hunting out there,
mm-hmm.
and I wanted him to haul my gear, legally he couldn't do it. Or if I shot a moose, he couldn't transport it back out down the Yetna and up to the Fiskalane.
With a transporter license, he could, sir.
Without a transporter's license, he couldn't do that.
If you paid him and you compensated him for that service, that would be correct. If you compensated him, then he would fall in the category of a transporter.
What is required to get a transporter license?
Simple application. If you're a pilot, you have to show that you have a one part 135 certificate, show that you have insurance, and basically fill out an application, pay a fee, and send in. And your obligation then is to send in a activity report.
Do you know of any, Mr. Chair? Mr. Johnson, do you know of anybody who's ever received a citation, or maybe Mr. Strickland is the one to ask for that from Hawk License? But do you know of anybody who's ever received a citation for transporting game or doing that type of activity without a license?
There have been several who have been cited for transporting and not following the state statutes. Those are state statutes.
That had a transporter's license.
That didn't have a transporter license. Those are state statutes.
Okay.
That is, the legislature is, and the governor is the one, of course, that worked together to put the state statutes, and that's what we have to, what we're following and work under.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any other questions for Mr. Johnson? Thanks again.
Yeah, thank you very much.
We have one person calling in from Kodiak, I believe, for answers only. Richard Rohr.
Yes, Mr. Chair. My name is Dick Rohr. I am the other guide member to the board. I don't think there's anything for me to add other than I encourage you to reauthorize the board for another 4 years. The board has worked really well together. I think everyone will tell you that. And since there's no other information to add to what you've heard, I'll answer questions if you have any.
Nope. I think you, thank you again for participating. Is there anybody else online that cares to comment on House Bill 315? With that kind of response, I think we'll bring it into the room. Is there anybody in the room that would care to comment that hasn't already? Oh, this is going way too smooth. back to the committee. What are the wishes of the committee on...
I'll move it.
I'll move House Bill 315.
Is there any opposition? Goes on to the next committee. Next bill is, we're going to be hearing today only at...
320.
Has some kinks that are being worked out as we speak, but we'll get it read across and get the basic information on it, and that's House Bill 320. Brief at ease. Brief at ease.
Hello.
So,
excellent. Well, Fish.
Save me. Kevin.
With us, we have Representative Kevin Myers and Michael Pulowski. Go for it. House Bill 320.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Chairman, apologize for the delay there. I was running down the stairs and ran into a group of nurses. So.
They needed search and rescue?
Oh, well, yeah. I guess.
I don't think we'll follow up on that
one. I guess
one,
if you're going to run into a group of people, that's a good group to run into. But, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'd like to talk to you today about House Bill 320, which has to do with workers' comp for search and rescue volunteers. We all live in Alaska, obviously, and we live here because of the excitement, the adventure, and of the wilderness. And we like exploring the wilderness, although sometimes the wilderness can be a bit dangerous. And I'm sure you all know of somebody, anyway, who's probably got off the beaten path and got lost or hurt. And when that happens, oftentimes it's the volunteers who are the first ones to come to these folks to rescue them. These are the search and rescue volunteers. In fact, oftentimes they're there before the state troopers are. They typically work together on a lot of these search and rescue efforts. In fact, in the past 6 years, search and rescue volunteers as well as the troopers rescued more than 2,300 people from the wilderness. So what this bill attempts to do is to, obviously we don't pay these folks, they're volunteers, but at least since these folks are out there risking their lives a lot of times on our behalf, is to at least provide them with workers' comp in case they do get hurt in the process. And currently in Alaska law, we do provide workers' comp for the volunteer emergency medical folks or technicians. So what this would do is that that section of law would just now extend it to also provide the same that we do for the medical technicians, volunteer medical technicians for the search and rescue volunteers. However, we strongly feel that if we are going to do this, we need to make sure that that these are legitimate organizations of search and rescue volunteers, and that's why we've asked the Department of Public Safety to oversee this and to certify the different search and rescue organizations. And since the standards to determine if they are legitimate and if they should receive certification will be done through regulation, and so the various groups will have the opportunity through the public hearing process to provide their input. But Mr. Chairman, in a nutshell, that's what this bill does. Again, we are relying on these volunteers to help and assist our public safety folks, and if we're going to do that, then we feel like we should provide them with workers' compensation coverage. Thank you.
Take a few questions.
Sure.
Representative Ramirez.
Thank you. Is the state self-insured for workers' comp?
Yes. I'm going to rely on my trusty staff here, Mr. Chairman.
Through the chair, Representative Ramirez, yes, the state is self-insured for workers' compensation.
I saw him shaking his head.
Representative Ledoux, followed by Representative Gatto.
Have there been very many instances of a volunteer worker ending up suing the state for something that happened while they were volunteering? And I ask that question because by providing the workers' compensation coverage, while this bill doesn't specifically say that, the effect of that is to take away the rights of these folks to sue for civil damages. So I guess I'd want to know what the instances, I mean, Was it a suit for civil damages that had anything to do with the introduction of this bill or anything?
Mr. Chairman, and again, I'm going to ask my trusty staff to help me out here because he's been doing most of the research. The reason why we're bringing this bill forward is on behalf of a constituent of ours who is part of the search and rescue volunteers, but it's my understanding that he's requesting this only because he understands that they're oftentimes in difficult situations where they could get hurt, and if they are hurt, they have no coverage. But the legal aspect hasn't come up that I know of. But I, with your permission, Mr. Chairman, I'll ask Mike if he's got some instances.
Thank you, Representative Ledoux, through the chair. Again, my name is Mike Pulowski, just for the record, and I'm an aide for Representative Meyer. I point you to 1860-125, and I can provide that for you and the rest of the committee either later. But it specifically under the search and rescue statutes is a civil immunity provision for the state. Really, the discussion, and I think Chuck Springer's online, as is Corey Ace with the Alaska Search and Rescue Association, is about being proactive before there is an accident in the backcountry where our volunteers get hurt. And the worry that if there was a major accident, what that would do to the volunteer pool when they found out they weren't covered. So it's about trying to do something before there's a problem.
Okay, so there already is civil immunity, so that this wouldn't have any negative impact there.
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, I believe that's correct, yes.
Okay.
Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions. These volunteers become state employees then while they're on search and rescue missions?
Representative Gatto, yes, that is correct. Just when they're being asked
Right. And the tough question, Mr. Doe is a laborer earning $50 an hour, goes on a search and rescue mission, and hurts his back, can no longer be a laborer at $50 an hour. What is the scenario that he says, hey, I was a state employee, I'm hurt, what do we owe him?
Mr. Chair, it says, it speaks to that in here. On page 2, line 15.
Of the bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ramos is absolutely correct. It does have a method in the bill itself for what our exposure would be.
Which is EMT wages? And that's what I'm trying to get at, is the $50 an hour employee is now a $10 an hour employee and has lost his livelihood. I don't know that he can't come back and say, you know, I was a state employee, I can't do my state employee job anymore. It's only a question of, is there a way to get ourselves mired in a lawsuit or in a, because I think we would probably be responsible certainly for rehabilitation, work comp rehabilitation, and they usually include, well, if you can't do your old job, we'll train you to do a new job, which could go on for a while. I think though that's fair. And if the new job doesn't pay $50 an hour and he says, that's what I'm used to and that's what I want, what happens?
Representative Gatto, through the chair, this is Mike Pulowski again. The policy call about how much coverage to provide a person acting in a volunteer role in a mission or under a training exercise is of course a policy call, and we decided to put them in line with an emergency medical technician. There's also volunteer firefighters. There's also disaster volunteers participating out of state. There's several different places in the workers' compensation statutes we could look at and what level of coverage that should be. For how the workers' comp system works, there is a representative from Department of Labor that we did not necessarily ask to be here but might be able to help the committee out with that in the room.
Follow-up?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a death benefit?
Representative Gatto, through the chair, I believe workers' compensation does have a death benefit, but I would turn to labor to back that up as well.
I believe that's correct. I'm not sure if it's 50,000 or some number, 100,000 possibly.
We have a couple people in the room that can probably answer that when we get to them later on. Representative Gardner.
Thank you very much. I started reading this bill, and it just from the title, everything made a lot of sense. But as I read into it, it raised some questions, and that is that we currently, under without this bill, we offer workers' comp as a state for volunteer ambulance attendants, for police officers and firefighters. And the police officers and firefighters obviously have the training and certification that we would want to have. I guess my question is, number one, do volunteer ambulance attendants also have some kind of certification or formal training in order to qualify to do that? And then the related question is search and rescue. I understand that the AMH, Alaska Mountain Rescue Group or whatever, does a pretty extensive training program. We've been trying to talk to them. We don't have a phone number, and they haven't yet answered our emails. But and they do a lot of training, and I'm sure that with lots of volunteers, unlike police and firefighters who volunteer somewhat professionally, people come and go. There's a lot of turnover. And so I guess I'm sort of concerned about adding a layer of certification for volunteers who are not professionally employed in related fields. And I'd like to know if DPS has an opinion about undertaking this, and if the Alaska Mountain Rescue Group has been consulted and what they have to say.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and Representative Gardner, you bring up some good points, and I'm going to again ask Mr. Pulaski to help me with some of it. But one of the concerns we have, as well as that you do and you've brought up here, is that we want these various groups to be approved by the Department of Safety so that, you know, they can make sure through the regulation process that we are getting qualified and trained people who are doing these rescue missions, and not somebody like myself that can't climb flat top anymore, let alone save somebody. As far as have we consulted other rescue groups on this, I'm going to ask Mike if to respond.
Representative Gardner, through the chair, this is Mike again. We have talked to both the Department of Public Safety and the Alaska Search and Rescue Association, which is kind of an umbrella group, and they are representatives of both, should be online. And you actually bring up a point that is one of the things we're currently talking about, and that's that perhaps the Department of Public Safety would prefer to authorize the organization rather than the individual members and leave the actual determination of the training up to the individual members. These groups currently work with the state in search and rescue operations, but you're absolutely correct. If you get down to the actual member role of all these different organizations, and actually in some places we're talking about animals as well, not just people, this could become cumbersome for the department. So we're within that discussion right now and perhaps leaning more towards just doing the organizations.
And the volunteer ambulance attendants, are those EMSs and wilderness first responder and that kind of thing, people that have training?
Representative Gardner, through the chair, I'd have to get back to you on what their actual criteria are.
And then a final kind of question. Is there a role for the non-professional citizen volunteer who isn't interested in a certification program to simply say, oh, I'm help. I want to help. There's lost kids or something to get out there. Is this legislation an impediment to that?
Representative Gardner, through the chair, we've been talking with different groups on this, and we don't believe that would be the case. I mean, you're talking about during a sanctioned search by the Department of Public Safety, that's when the coverage should be conducted. I think the perfect example is the helicopter that went down in Prince William Sound recently out of, I believe, the chairman's district. There were some members on that helicopter. There were searches conducted prior to and afterwards, and this would not affect those. What it would affect is providing coverage for the searchers during the period of the search. So you're not blocking people from it. You're just saying when they are covered as state employees. And that's up to the Commissioner of Public Safety when to cut that off is what we're talking about.
Thank you.
One more?
Well, I'm just sort of struck by a sanctioned search. trying to think. I'm just concerned that we don't have so many layers of is it sanctioned and is this person certified that we actually have an impediment to people's natural desire to jump in and help when a kid's lost or what something's happened and they're looking.
Representative Gardner, and through the chair, that's certainly not our intent, and we wouldn't want that to happen. And I think maybe we can make that clear, if not verbally, perhaps a letter of intent, so that when they do write the regulations, they don't prohibit what you're speaking of.
Thank you. So we don't say, oh, thanks for your help in looking, but we can't use you. Right. You don't have the certification.
Representative Newman, followed by Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Pawlowski, I'm assuming, or Representative Meyer. You know, these folks are generally pretty well trained. They're trained to look for problems and to make sure that they don't end up in an accident themselves, in an avalanche or whatever the case may be. Within the last 20 years, how many claims or accident reports have been filed that could have possibly been claims, you know, would this have been? How many people would have been affected by this in the last 20 years?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Newman, we've heard of two. Now there may be more, but that's all.
So two. So we're trying to. I'm just trying to put this into scope of what we're talking about here. Is, you know, they do receive some pretty good training, but things happen. I mean, they wouldn't be in that situation if they weren't out there because something bad did happen. But I think they receive some pretty good training, and if they're out there, they. You know, if they're caught in an accident, they should be compensated for it, at least the minimum benefits that an EMT would get, which is very minimal. But we're talking two within the last 20 years that we know of, so that's a little perspective. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just trying to help. Sometimes search is not followed by rescue, it's followed by recovery. And I'm curious, is it your intent to include people that are involved in recovery? Sometimes recovery is more dangerous than rescue.
Representative Gatto, through the chair, the conversation that's going on right now between Department of Public Safety and our office has been the when that coverage should go on. And what we're looking at is 1860-120, which is the Commissioner of Public Safety's authority mm-hmm. to conduct search and rescue. And I believe recovery falls into that as well. But really linking it back to the commissioner's decision under express statutes to go out and conduct these and authorize them and oversee them and conduct those trainings. So it's not a volunteer search, but it is also sadly a recovery sometime too. And I'm looking at the statute right now, 1860-120 does include retrieving the person or the person's remains. So that would be covered.
Okay, so it is covered. Thank you.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I have another question. I think you touched on it, but I'm not certain I fully understand the answer. And that is, can you speak a little bit about the genesis of the bill? I mean, how you came to do this?
Go ahead, Mike.
Representative Gardner, through the chair, it was brought to Representative Meyer's attention through a constituent who works with the Alaska Search and Rescue Association. I believe they're online. This has been an ongoing discussion within the search and rescue community, I think, for quite a while.
Thank you.
Representative Ledoux.
Okay, so I got a question. So let's say you're a firefighter and you work for, let's say, some municipality, and you're making some decent wages as a paid firefighter. But then you go to your home, which is outside of the municipality, and so they've got a volunteer firefighting department. So you volunteer as a search and rescue, I guess, with respect to this volunteer activity. So if you end up hurt, you'd end up not getting your wages as a firefighter. Am I correct? It would just be
You're correct, through the chair, Representative Ledoux. I think the way it's defined here in the bill, and again, Mike, you may want to help me, is that it's the gross weekly earnings of a medical technician in the city or village nearest to where the rescue mission was held.
But that's still better off than getting nothing.
That's correct.
And they're getting the full medical benefits. We're just talking about the lost income. They're they're not apportioning out the cost of the
That's correct.
Treatment. Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If it didn't actually happen this way, I wouldn't be able to comment, but as an Anchorage firefighter, I volunteered in Mat-Su, different municipality, and was prohibited by the Anchorage Fire Department from volunteering somewhere else. And their statement was, well, if you get hurt, all that training we gave you dissolves, and now we got to fire you and go hire someone else. So we often find agreements of reciprocity between different administrations and different areas that allow for mutual response. In those cases, if you were an Anchorage firefighter who was paid a good salary, but with mutual response responded to a different area, you would be considered as on duty for the purposes of work comp and the purposes of injury within the original fire department that you worked for, which is maybe a special case, but a lot of the volunteers are often, not often, I couldn't say, but like myself, it was one of the things I wanted to do was volunteer in the other district, and I expect that it was common that happened. So there is the special case where you wouldn't be paid the minimum amount of an EMT wage, but you would be paid as if you fell off the fire truck right there on 4th Avenue rather than out in the Mat-Su Borough.
Any further questions for Representative Myers or Mr. Pulaski? I think we'll go to the people off net, starting with Lieutenant Dial, Alaska State Troopers.
Well,
are you with us, Lieutenant Dial?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm here.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Yes, my name is Rodney Dial. I'm a lieutenant with Alaska State Troopers.
Please continue.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The Department of Public Safety is somewhat supportive of the bill as amended, which removes the responsibility for DPS to set qualifications to certify and to maintain a registry, with the concerns that we feel coverage should be limited to actual missions and not training, and also with the concern that, and just be that everyone is aware that there will be an expense to the department to pay the premium for the workers' compensation coverage. At this time, the department administration is not able to provide us with what that cost will actually be. Thank you.
Any questions for Lieutenant Dial? Thank you very much. We have one question. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Just to make sure I understand, the Department of Public Safety does not want to have the responsibility for setting standards, maintaining the records. Is that what you said?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, our concern is that if we are required to do those things, it will result in a substantial fiscal note. It's a very demanding undertaking, and to do it right, we would need to hire additional people to do that.
Follow up.
Thank you. How would you feel about some sort of arrangement that delegated that to an existing board or organization that's currently doing such things?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, that would be something we would have to discuss with the commissioner.
Thank you,
Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Lieutenant Dial. The fiscal note for public safety indicates $500,000 for the first year and differing amounts for later years. Is all of that training money, or is a part of that part of work comp insurance?
Representative Gatto, through the chair, that is all for the personnel and the assorted infrastructure to support the personnel. It does not include any of the costs associated with workers' compensation coverage premiums.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lieutenant Dial. Chuck Springer, are you with us? Chuck? How about Corey?
Oh, hello, yes, Corey is here.
Okay. Please state your name and affiliation for the record, please.
My name is Corey Aist, and I'm the current president of Alaska Search and Rescue Association.
Well, thank you for joining us. Please continue.
Along with Lieutenant Dial, I believe most search and rescue organizations would be in favor of such a bill to help offset the chance that someone was injured in a search and rescue effort. The interesting thing is that there are search and rescues occurring across the state weekly, if not daily, and many of those are carried on by a joint effort of the Alaska State Troopers, other agencies, and a whole mess of volunteers. And I think this bill is going in the correct direction, according to some of these changes.
Any questions for Corey? Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Aist, for the work you do and for testifying here. Can you speak a little bit about the certification provisions of this bill? Do you currently have a program that certifies volunteers? If the state were to do it, would you be interested in doing something under state authority? And what proportion of your volunteers do you think would participate in a certification program?
Thank you, Representative Gardner, through the chair. Certification is a difficult issue. In search and rescue, you don't necessarily have. We're actually moving away from what we call certifications and towards standards. They kind of mean two different things. A standard has a list of criteria that would make someone what we call mission ready or operational, and each organization around the state, depending on their expertise, creates a standard that that their members need to meet to become active and help the troopers. So when the troopers call a mountain rescue group, their members are going to have specific training and a standard in which to meet versus a snowmobile group or a search and rescue dog group. So I think from my experience, the troopers have a very good understanding of the organizations in which they work from and call on those organizations to supply the volunteers needed for a particular mission. And whether the troopers want to monitor the standards in which organizations are adhering to, or they want to task that to maybe an association or another group, I think is worth considering.
So using the language of certifications or standards, do you think that that wouldn't be an impediment or dramatically change the way you're doing business now?
Well, the word certification really does get a lot of people upset, because certification is a degree, or there are different elements of search and rescue that have different certifications. But if we were to change the language to standards, you know, in which an organization's meeting certain standards set by DPS, then I think that there would be more more interest by search and rescue organizations around the state, because they already have their standards.
Thank you. One more question. Can you speak a little bit about turnover?
Turnover in the search and rescue community? There is quite a bit of turnover in the search and rescue community. What you have is you have a core set of individuals that respond to a large majority of the searches that take place in any region. And then as a search grows and develops, such as Turnagain Pass, those professional volunteers in which the troopers normally work with grows to what we call spontaneous volunteers, where all of a sudden it's people from the community who have no training, and all of a sudden become a responsibility of the trained volunteers to oversee in a search operation, kind of takes place. So it's kind of an interesting mix of occurrences that happen on any search mission. But our numbers and our statistics show that actually a large number of searches take place by a core set of individuals and organizations from organizations in those regions.
Thank you very much.
Representative Ramos.
Thank you, Mr. Eist. Is this why the chairman and I separately are working on a steady funding source for the Fire Safety Standards Council? Is this some of the benefit of a program like this? Is what it lends to standardizing an effort to broaden out the Corps of volunteers and provide them some sort of standard for their training?
Well, I'm not familiar with that organization or that tasking. I'm not sure if your question is, if you're asking me if we would be part of that or if we could be part of that.
No, that's okay. Apparently, it's not germane. Thank you.
Okay. And I'm sorry, I'm not following protocol. I'm unfamiliar with the pot frog.
Oh, you're doing great. Sorry. Thanks.
Representative Gatto.
Hopefully, it's the last question. I want to thank you for the work you do. I know how important it is to the community to know you're out there. I did want to bring up one thing, or maybe a couple, and that is the expense, the enormous expense of equipment. Swiftwater rescue equipment requires an owner to have a dry suit and scuba gear, never mind the training, mountain rescue, ropes and hardware, helmets. Typically, individuals have been paying for that, but as that gets damaged or lost or used up, do you feel there's something in the legislation that allows money for replacement, or would this money simply be dedicated so that that still becomes on the user's obligation to replace for himself?
Representative Gatto, there is a large set responsibility on the individual volunteers to obtain equipment and provide for their own training and such when it comes to search and rescue. I would also add that in my experiences, I've been very fortunate as a dog handler based in Anchorage to travel around the state. I've had an incredible relationship with the Alaska State Troopers and have been treated extremely professional in every instance I've ever participated with them on a search. They have, Lieutenant Dial may know more, but my understanding is that they have a budget for replacement of search and rescue equipment to volunteers when that equipment is damaged or lost on a search mission.
Okay.
I don't know about replacement of equipment as it wears out, per se. But
follow up?
And this is funny, but I'm guessing it would not replace rescue dogs.
No. The unfortunate part of training rescue dogs is we outlive our dogs far too easily.
Yeah, and thanks again for your work.
Thank you.
Thanks again, Mr. Hayes. I think Chuck Powers Chuck Springer may be with us. Chuck, are you back? Chuck? Chuck Springer, I give up.
Yes, sir? This is Chuck Springer.
Thank you for joining us. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Yes, my name is Chuck Springer. I'm the past president of Alaska Search and Rescue Association and a volunteer member of the APD Auxiliary Search Team and an observer with the Alaska State Trooper Hilo 1, the helicopter.
Well, thank you for your service, and please continue.
The purpose behind the concept of offering workers' comp to the various different searchers that are serving all of us in the state has to do with the concept of trying to protect the families in the event that someone's hurt. It's been a concern of mine during my presidency with the association, and I know through Corey's, that there may in the future be an incident where one of our people is hurt or killed. And we don't want a family to be destroyed as a result of that. And we're looking at this as a way of at least trying to protect that family in the event of one of these searchers is hurt or killed in the field.
there any questions for Mr. Springer? Now, thanks again for joining us. Is there anybody else online that would care to testify on this bill? Then I think we'll bring it into the room, and I know we have at least one person signed up. Paul Lasanke, please join us.
For the record, my name is Paul F. Lasanke. I'm the director of the Division of Workers' Compensation within the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, and I signed up to answer any questions that you might have. I don't have any prepared statements. I can just say, getting back to, through the chair, getting back to Representative Gatto's question, yes, there is indeed death benefits that are provided under the Workers' Compensation Act, so they would... under this bill, they would be part of the panoply of benefits that would be paid out to volunteers.
How much they are?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, it really depends on your family status. If you're a single person, there's a death benefit of $5,000 and a one-time payment to the second injury fund of $10,000. That's assuming that you have no surviving spouse, no surviving children, and no surviving dependent parents. If, on the other hand, you have a spouse and children, then you would get essentially what you weekly benefits would be payable to the survivors for that are roughly equivalent to what you would have gotten as what we would call permanent total disability benefits, and they would be paid out for a significant period of time that can be cut off by remarriage or after the passage of, I believe it's 12 years, unless the surviving spouse is of a certain age, in which case they wouldn't be cut off. So there is no specific dollar amount other than for the single person that dies without dependents.
Follow up. Is there a federal benefit?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, if there is, I'm not aware of it. That is, workers' compensation benefit just in general. I don't have any specific expertise as far as federal benefits available to search and rescue folks.
I'm strongly suspicious that there is a federal death benefit for personnel in maybe all of public safety, but just wanted it on the record if there was.
Any further questions for Mr. Lasanke? Thanks for joining us. You got off light? Sure. I think with that, we're going to not take any activity on the or action on the bill today. I believe we're going to have a CS ready by the beginning of next week, and I think at that point in time, we'll keep the public testimony open until that point in time, too, until everybody gets a chance to take a look at the CS, and I think with that, we'll adjourn at 10 minutes after 4.
Too early.